assistive gear, let's call it. So when the number is on zero, when you pedal for like one round, it doesn't assist you at all. But as the number goes up, it assists you more and more. So if you pedal the same amount and the number is on like three, it pushes you a lot further than if this number was set to zero. This is great for those times when you feel like you're really burned out and you can't pedal that much, especially when you're in an upward slope. So you increase this number, you get more assistance from the electric motor to push yourself forward a lot more. Now it's time for me to take it for a quick little spin. So this throttle is the difference between enjoying bike riding and not so much enjoying it and looking at it as a chore and just a workout. I have been like one of the people that I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the type that wants to bike to more places but doesn't do it because I find myself burned out too quickly when I'm going up a slope. With this, I can enjoy the flat surfaces and the downward slopes in biking, which are a lot more enjoyable than the upward slopes, and just skip the difficult slopes. So I'm seriously considering getting one of these electric bikes myself. And with that, we have come to the end of the program. Until next week.
What an awesome report, as always. Many thanks. Now, let's finish off the program with a look at some news and trends in this sector. As we mentioned, there is a trend of adding value to items to increase their uses and profits. And Iran's nanotech industry is paving the way for a variety of added value products, particularly in the plastics industry.
Iran's Nanotechnology Innovation Council estimates that roughly 800 kinds of Iranian-made nanotech products are in the domestic market. One of these is the development of biodegradable plastic bags through nanotech research. Iran's advanced products in this sector are sent to nearly 50 countries worldwide. Last year, these exports generated over $700 million. Iran is among the top five countries in nanoscience production and scientific achievements in this field.
Plastics are a vital component in Iran's medical device production as well. And this sector is seriously booming with new products each year that help save people's lives.
Last year, Iran produced thousands of medical devices, which it exported to 56 countries worldwide. Iran generally holds a 1% share of the global medical equipment market. Moreover, the Ministry of Health says Iran's stake is worth over $500 billion. That's 200 times more than its value in 2018, demonstrating how fast this sector is growing.
Speaking of plastic, one cannot overlook the harmful impact its waste has on the environment. It's terrible. And plastic bags have the most amount of waste, both domestically and worldwide.
Iran produces some 490 tons of plastic waste each day, and one-third of this is from plastic bags. While Iran recycles a lot of its plastic, controlling this waste is still an uphill battle considering production and consumer practices. Therefore, Iran's Environmental Protection Agency has embarked on detailing more regulations for reducing the use of plastic bags. The draft regulations include replacing plastic bags with biodegradable versions and creating production standards for environmentally compatible plastics. Most importantly, the draft addresses ways to reduce plastic bag use altogether.
Well, that covers today's bazaar. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The flagrant human rights violations, the wars, and the near constant bombardments in Gaza, coupled with Israeli regime's 15-year-long blockade there, and the havoc the regime troops wreak across the West Bank, where violent raids are the norm, have made our lives extremely hard, our fates precarious and our futures uncertain, says Qada al-Haddad, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Why is the world so indifferent to Gaza? Stay tuned for more. Qada al-Haddad, Gaza-based journalist, recounts her experience in Gaza. It was around afternoon prayers when my sister called to warn us that there was escalation, that the situation looked dangerous. Take care of yourself, she said in a trembling voice. War again, sighed my nephew just 16, she said. Her family was supposed to pay a visit to her aunt to congratulate her on her daughter's Taujihi or high school results, which had been announced 2 weeks earlier. That was the plan, but plans in Gaza turned to dust, just like the buildings the Zionist regime bombs, and the bombing started on that Friday, August 5th. For the next few days, they lived in a far too familiar emergency. All of a sudden, they had to cancel all the plans. They decided to stay at home. Her brother turned the radio on. She hates the radio. It's always bad news. She turned it off. Her brother turned it on again. She escaped to social media. All her friends' news feeds were filled with fearful posts about what was coming. Above them all, the drones started hovering and buzzing. The anxiety-inducing soundtrack became louder and louder. Several of her nieces and nephews were around. They leaned to listen to their conversation. One asked, "How many wars have you witnessed? At first I thought they were joking. They weren't." Came one answer, "Two wars." Came another, "All the wars." "All wars except one." Was one when the 2014 war happened. Strange it is that Gazans measure their age by the number of wars they have witnessed, or rather, how strange it is not, having lived through repeated wars without any chance to recover from trauma leaves emotional scars. People are angry, people grow anxious, there is depression, there is substance abuse, and they ask questions that come from such bitter experience. Will it last as long as the 2014 war? Will it be short but deadly like the 2012? Will it be like 2021? War, no matter how long or short, is war. Comparisons fail to convey that all wars are, in a fundamental sense, the same. As it turned out, but how were they to know? The war this time lasted 3 days. But it was still war. War is about losses. It is about death and destruction. War is fear. War is anxiety. War is helplessness. War is horror. This one showed yet again their inability to protect themselves, their families, and their loved ones, and the brutality of the fake regime of Israel. The UN confirmed a total of 46 Palestinians dead, including 17 children. Gaza's Ministry of Health reported 360 injured, including at least 151 children, 58 women and 19 older persons. More questions. Are Gazan lives so cheap that no one cares for them? Why is the world so indifferent to what is happening to Gazans, but so angry about Ukraine? The flagrant human rights violations, the wars, and the near-constant bombardments in Gaza, coupled with the Zionist regime's 15-year-long blockade there, and the havoc Israeli regime troops wreak across the West Bank, where violent raids are the norm, have made the Gaza people's lives extremely hard, their fate precarious, and their futures uncertain. Nights are the worst. In war, night strikes fear into their heart. All of a sudden, short summer nights become unbearably long. Nights are for death. It was just after nightfall that Gaza people heard about the Rafah massacre that killed 7, one of them just 13. Nights are for fear. 1.5-year-old nephew of Qadal Haddad will not stop jumping around, whether off the sofa or climbing in the kitchen or running. For that, they call him Monkey. He was startled one time when a loud explosion struck nearby. Qada held him close. She could feel his heart pounding in his tiny body. It is said that you own the future. This may be true of the rest of the world. People in Gaza or nothing, not even tomorrow night. The ceasefire brokered by Egypt and the UN came into effect on August 7th, 23:30 local time. They were expected to go back to normal as if nothing happened. They are supposed to just cope with the trauma, the fear, the unemployment, the poverty, the insecurity, the lack of any future, the lack of options because of the Zionist regime's blockade. What is normal in Gaza? There are no jobs, there is no freedom of movement, there are no prospects. Electricity is rationed, the water is contaminated and scarce. Normal. They checked up on all their relatives. They offered their condolences to those grieving. They know this is not the last time Palestinian blood will be shed so cheaply.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It is widely believed that the war in Ukraine is causing a global food crisis. But how could this be true? Ukraine is one of the world's biggest exporters of green essentials, like wheat and corn. But most of its products can't even leave the country. This is causing serious problems in places where they depend most on this supply, like the Middle East and Africa. There's so many ripple effects from the war, but it's hard to overstate just how big the impact of the grain crisis is. Along with the shortages, you've also got the rising prices of fertilizers and fuel, as well as natural disasters due to climate change like drought, which has only further worsened the situation globally. And now UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned of a global food crisis as the West's anti-Russia stance is creating obstacles to the flow of Russian products and fertilizers to the world. Guterres said that the global food crisis triggered by the Ukraine conflict looms over the world. The UN chief says the West's sanctions on Russia have exacerbated the poor situation of the global economy.
They are trying to use all kinds of arguments. Some are, real, based on something. Some are absolutely spurious and based on nothing, to somehow get the public opinion against Russia. And that concerns this story of grain. Russia and other countries produce, much more grain than Ukraine. So the very idea that Africa will somehow starve, not because of misguided Western policies, not because of the prices which, West commands, but because five boats of grain which cannot leave Odessa, it's a joke. There were tons of possibilities for even that grain to go, and there is endless amount of possibilities to get grain from Russia, from France, and so on. So that was all mobilized by Ukraine to somehow turn the opinions that it's like all Russia fault. Children are dying in Africa, Russian fall, isn't it? And unfortunately, Antonio Guterres, rather than approaching the whole thing objectively, coming to the, territory, exploring it, asking questions, saying, what can we do? He more or less channels the information which is given to him by Ukraine.
But despite this, only a few nations seem to be pushing for diplomatic efforts in an attempt to restore the global supply chains, and other countries, mainly the US and its allies, continue their anti-Russia stance, pushing ahead with their foreign policy. The impact of the West's war on Russia through sanctions can be felt globally. Global supply chains have been disrupted, fears of food shortages are rising, and countries' economies have also taken a hit. But despite the heavy costs incurred by the people worldwide, the US and many European leaders seem to have set their eyes on pushing ahead with their sanctions policy instead of opting for diplomacy. Russia is a major exporter of potash, ammonia, urea, and other soil nutrients, and the supply of all these fertilizers, which are necessities for efficient production of corn, soy, rice, and wheat, has been heavily disrupted as a result of Western sanctions on Russia. A clear example of this would be Brazilian farmers, who are forced to use less fertilizers considering the shortages created in their country. In some African countries, farmers are reverting to using manure to nourish their crops. And in North America, some farmers have stockpiled fertilizers for the 2023 season in anticipation of higher prices. Meanwhile, in the United States, fertilizer bills are expected to jump 12% this year, and that's according to the American Farm Bureau Federation and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA data.
No, I think the whole war is definitely, you know, war in general is, should be avoided. But this one is just very cynical calculation. Somehow the leadership of NATO, leadership in Washington, decided that it's a win-win situation. A, we, you know, get opinion against Russia. B, we'll get sanctions against Russia, which will benefit us, our gas companies, our oil companies, our military companies. And see, it even has a chance to weaken Russia, which is like our enemy, to weaken Russia militarily. So they're pumping Ukraine with military forces. They're trying to push them to the battlefield. In the battlefield, Russians are killed, Ukrainians are killed in great numbers, while, you know, leadership, Ukrainian leadership buys fancy cars for themselves and they don't send their children to the front. They send some poor people to the front. So this is just exercising the bloodshed, out of which many people hope to, you know, get some economic benefit.
But while standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. Instead of following diplomacy similar to Turkey in an attempt to solve the ongoing crisis, the West continues to follow its warmongering aspirations and further sanction Russia. The fall of the US dollar is happening, 1 cent at a time. While there is a decline in the US standing as a superpower, there is also the harsh reality that the US is facing, the decline of the US dollar. All the signs are there. Shares of the US dollar in reserves held by central banks has fallen to its lowest level. The US, the most indebted nation ever, also has a sovereign debt crisis, another sign that it may be heading to a dollar collapse. The US use of the dollar as a weapon, like sanctions, has made other countries resist using it in their trade. Yet countries like Iran, Russia, and China are moving towards the elimination of the dollar altogether. This is why Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin has said, against the growing geopolitical pressure from the collective West, the only way to guarantee stable trade, economic and investment ties between Russia and its partners is to avoid the dollar and the euro and switch to settlements in acceptable alternatives, primarily in national currencies. His reference to the growing geopolitical pressure from the West are sanctions from the US and its European allies due to Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. But these sanctions have been heavily used against Russia starting from the year 2014.
When it comes to trade, if you want to move away from the dollar, as we're supposed to say Russian ruble, it's going to be very difficult indeed. Of course, you can trade in ruble and other currencies, but the key thing is you need them to be liquid. That's the easy to buy and sell and a decent size. And also the margin or the difference between the buying and selling costs, all of this can make it more difficult. Therefore, if you're trading in dollars, the price is normally going to be sharper. If you're trading in, say, another currency, well, you may find it's illiquid, as barren as a desert, and not be able to complete your trade.
The de-dollarization move was thrown into fast gear when the US Treasury Department decided to confiscate Russia's dollar foreign exchange reserves. This made other countries think twice about holding their reserves in the dollar currency. After all, these countries have concluded that their country could be the next if it does not abide by US foreign policy. They can be a victim of secondary sanctions at a minimum. Therefore, it was a natural progression for countries like Russia, China, and Iran to trade with their own national currencies. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin has said that mechanisms for settlement in national currencies other than Western ones have been successfully created with a number of nations, and the possibility of paying in rubles for certain categories of Russian export goods, including energy and food products, has been set up.
It's going to be interesting to see actually what happens with the dollar now, because I suspect there's going to be quite a lot of weakness of it. Why? Well, because the global economy is slowing down for one key reason. But nonetheless, dollar is normally seen as a safer haven than other currencies. So what you'll find is actually people will go to the dollar in times of emergency because they know it's actually got depth, liquidity, and obviously the treasury standing behind it. If you were using another currency, those things would not be as strong and it would not be as straightforward to be able to run a business like that.
The BRICS, SCO, and other international platforms have intensified their multilateral discourse on the subject. And this is very significant since the US has fallen out of favor with many countries and are gravitating eastward or away from the US. Take the case of Brazil. Presidential candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has recommended using a Latin American currency to be free of the US dollar. Lula has pledged many things that don't involve the US and the dollar, such as strengthening its relations with Latin America, vowing to revive the BRICS system, integrating Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in an independent economic architecture to challenge Western financial hegemony. The BRICS have also been discussing the development of a BRICS pay multilateral wallet and currency.
Early on Thursday, the Israeli military has shot down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. The military broke into the offices of the organizations and confiscated property. Palestinians' foreign ministry has censored the raids as an attempt to silence the voice of truth and justice, saying rights groups remain the prime target of the regime because they document its crimes against Palestinians. Six of the organizations raided had been criminalized as terrorist organizations in October 2021 by Israel, which claimed they were affiliated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless. The organizations targeted on Thursday work in fields such as human rights, prisoner support, children's rights, and healthcare. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations by Israel, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bisan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees. Since 1967, Israel has banned more than 400 local and international organizations, including all major Palestinian political parties. Analysts speculate that Israel had attacked the groups because they were becoming increasingly effective at exposing Israel's repression of Palestinian people.
That their Achilles heel is their ongoing horrific violations of human rights, which are losing them support throughout the world. And so they're apparently thinking that they can kill the messenger and get rid of those who are reporting on their crimes just by shutting them down on spurious pretenses.
The Israeli army has deprived generations of Palestinians in the West Bank of their basic civil right, including the right to expression, regularly using military force to suppress Palestinian people. The latest raid on Palestinian non-governmental human rights organizations and their designations as terrorist organizations have been denounced by UN experts and were rejected by nine European states that fund the targeted groups. The European countries also called Israel's allegations against the NGOs unsubstantiated. Last year, Israel's leading human rights group, Betzalim said in a report that Israel is not a democracy but an apartheid regime that systematically oppresses the Palestinians via military occupation and racist laws, is using laws, practices, and organized violence to cement the supremacy of one group over another.
Israel is obviously trying to silence the voices of critics who've been documenting the ongoing abuses of human rights, the murders of children, shooting down teenagers, bombing targets, and killing all sorts of people, often at random. They're essentially ongoing massacres, not to mention the torture, which is a systematic feature of Israeli policy.
Israeli policies and practices toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories should be scrutinized, but only condemning Israeli raids on Palestinian civil society groups is not enough. It's high time the UN and international organizations took direct action against Israeli atrocities.
Tensions are rising between Turkey and Syria. Ankara has launched airstrikes on military posts in northern Syria, killing several army soldiers and injuring several more. There are now concerns that a military operation in northern Syria by Turkish forces is imminent. Sources say a new cross-border offensive by Turkey looms large. Turkish forces have reportedly used loudspeakers in mosques in border areas close to the Jarabulus city to ask people to stay indoors in preparation for the operation. Reports also say numerous Turkish combat drones could be seen flying in the skies over areas in proximity to the frontier. Turkish soldiers are also mobilizing in most of the border towns of Hasaka, Raqqa, and Aleppo provinces. The Turkish president has already hinted at a possible military incursion. On August 8th, Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara's decision to establish a 30-kilometer deep secure line along the country's southern border is final. Ankara says it's going to curb Kurdish militants operating in that area.
They want actually to annex the northern part of Syria. This is an ambition that Turkey has to regain, to enlarge some territory that it once had. And I think this is not something that is acceptable either to Syria or even to Russia. Russia wants to have good relations with Turkey, but not at this price, I think.
The US-backed Kurdish People's Protection Unit, or YPG, militant group, which is the backbone of SDF, is present there. Ankara says YPG militants are terrorists. Damascus has warned Ankara against violating its sovereignty. Both Iran and Russia, which have been aiding Damascus in its anti-terror campaign, are also against Turkey's possible offensive. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019. Back then, Turkish forces launched a cross-border invasion to push YPG militants away. Since 2016, Turkey has launched three military operations inside Syria. When the crisis began on Syria in 2011, Ankara backed militants fighting against the government in Damascus. For years, it provided them with weapons and military support in a bid to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
So this is perhaps just what we sometimes call a red herring, that is something that will distract the observers from what is actually going on. It makes Turkey appear to be reasonable when in fact they don't have a reasonable agenda at all. They have an unreasonable agenda.
However, there are signs that Turkey may have changed its policy on Syria. Just recently, it was revealed that the Turkish foreign minister had a brief conversation with his Syrian counterpart last October. The top Turkish diplomat has stressed that there needs to be a reconciliation between opposition groups and the Damascus government. There are reports that Ankara was evaluating the possibility of starting talks with the Syrian government. The leader of Turkey's Nationalist Movement Party has also supported comments to mend relations with neighboring Syria. Turkey now appears to be in a difficult position. The country's economy is now in its worst situation in decades. It's spending nearly $2 billion in northern Syria annually. And sentiments against Syrian refugees in Turkey are rising. That could potentially cost Erdogan his political career. In order to fix it, Erdogan needs to establish relations with Syria.
I think it's going to be a major problem. The Turkish attack indicates that they are not going to accept a reasonable compromise and to respect the territorial integrity of Syria. So this is going to be a major problem.
But at the same time, Ankara does not want to lose Syria card with regards to anti-Assad militants. However, it's possible military adventure in northern Syria could trigger another catastrophe in a country which is in the midst of a prolonged crisis.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit temporarily blocked Senator Lindsey Graham from testifying before a special grand jury investigating Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election results in Georgia. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalist Richard Fawcett. The piece is titled, Federal Appeals Court Halts Graham Testimony Before Atlanta Grand Jury. Federal appeals court temporarily blocked Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, on Sunday, 21st of August, from testifying in the investigation into efforts by President Donald J. Trump and his allies to overturn the 2020 presidential election results in Georgia. The appeals court instructed a lower court to determine whether Senator Graham should be exempt from answering certain kinds of questions, given his status as a federal lawmaker. The ruling by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit gives a temporary reprieve to Senator Graham, who has been fighting prosecutors' efforts to bring him before a special grand jury. After a protracted bout of legal sparring, Senator Graham, at the end of last week, appeared to have failed in his effort to remain above the matter and had been expected to testify behind closed doors on Tuesday in a downtown Atlanta, Georgia courthouse. Senator Lindsey Graham has argued, among other things, that he should be exempt from testifying under U.S. Constitution's speech and debate clause, which prohibits asking lawmakers about their legitimate legislative functions. The appeals court laid out further steps on Sunday that must be taken before Senator Graham gives any testimony. First, the court ruled a federal district court must determine whether Senator Graham is entitled to a partial quashing or modification of the subpoena to appear before the special purpose grand jury, based on the speech and debate clause issue. After that, the appeals court said it will take up the issue for further consideration. Lawyers for Senator Graham have said that he was informed by Fulton County prosecutors that he was a witness, not a target in the case. Even so, prosecutors want Senator Lindsey Graham's testimony for a number of reasons. Among them are two phone calls that he made just after the 2020 presidential election to Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's Secretary of State, in which Senator Graham inquired about ways to help Donald Trump by invalidating certain mail-in votes. They also want him to answer other questions about what they have called the multi-state coordinated efforts to influence the results of the November 2020 election in Georgia and elsewhere. Prosecutors have said in court documents that they expect Senator Graham's testimony to reveal additional sources of information related to their investigation. This month, Senator Lindsey Graham called the effort to make him testify ridiculous and a weaponization of the law. "We will go as far as we need to go and do whatever needs to be done to make sure that people like me can do their jobs without fear of some county prosecutor coming after you," he said. The speech and debate clause appears in Article 1, Section 6 of the U.S. Constitution and states that members of Congress shall not be questioned in any other place for any speech or debate in either house. The framers of the Constitution wrote it with the idea of protecting the independence of the legislative branch of the government from the other branches of the government, and were influenced by the evolution of an independent parliament in England. In essence, the intention of the clause is to shield members of Congress from having to worry that anything they say in the course of legislative activities will implicate them in a lawsuit, according to an analysis by John Vile, a political science professor at Middle Tennessee State University. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the clause extends to purely legislative activities, but not to political activities. The clause has been invoked in a number of criminal cases in recent years involving legislators, including former Representative Chris Collins, Republican of New York, who claimed that federal prosecutors had violated the clause in a securities fraud case against him. But a judge ruled that the Justice Department had not violated the clause in securing certain congressional materials, and Chris Collins pleaded guilty to criminal charges in 2019. Senator Robert Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, also invoked the clause when he fought a corruption case that resulted in a mistrial, leading the Justice Department to eventually drop the criminal charges against him in 2018. Last Monday, U.S. District Judge Lee Martin May ordered Lindsey Graham to testify, writing that prosecutors had shown that there was a special need for Senator Graham's testimony on issues relating to alleged attempts to influence or disrupt the lawful administration of Georgia's 2022 elections. Senator Lindsey Graham appealed his case to the 11th Circuit and argued to Judge May that he should not have to testify until the appeals process was concluded. The prosecutor leading the investigation, District Attorney Fannie Willis of Fulton County, Georgia, pushed back. In a court filing, Fannie Willis said that the resolution of Senator Graham's appeal might not come for months, hampering her efforts to flesh out a broader investigation in a timely fashion. Fannie Willis has said that the case could result in racketeering or conspiracy charges involving multiple defendants. Judge May has thus far been skeptical about Senator Lindsey Graham's claim that he should not have to testify at all, writing that there are multiple topics upon which Senator Graham could face questioning that in no way implicate protected legislative activity under the speech or debate clause. These topics, she wrote, include acts that are political in nature rather than legislative, and that would encompass any coordination with the Trump campaign, effort to cajole or exhort Georgia election officials to change election results or election processes. And any public statements or speeches that Senator Lindsey Graham made outside of Congress about the 2020 presidential elections. She also warned against an overboard application of the speech and debate clause. Doing so, she said, would allow any sitting senator to shield all manner of potential criminal conduct occurring during a phone call merely by asserting the purpose of the call was legislative fact-finding, no matter whether the call subsequently took a different turn. Even though Senator Lindsey Graham's testimony in front of the special grand jury has been delayed, the appellate court seemed to signal that it may approve future questioning of Senator Graham not covered by the speech and debate clause. So they don't want the speech and debate protected questions to be asked. But as to the rest of the subpoena, the rest of the questions, they're signaling that they will allow it, said Norman Eisen, a lawyer who served as special counsel to the House Judiciary Committee during the first impeachment and trial of Donald Trump. In an email on Sunday, Norman Eisen said, "Note that they are remanding to a district court judge who has already made her views clear that many of the questions that the district attorney wants to ask are permissible and not within the bounds of the speech and debate clause." In the Georgia investigation, the speech and debate clause was also invoked by Representative Jody Heiss, Republican of Georgia, and a Donald Trump ally, as he sought to quash his own subpoena to appear before the special grand jury. In that matter, Judge May ruled that Jody Heiss must testify, while noting that some questions may be off-limits. Language similar to that of the speech and debate clause exists in the Georgia Constitution, and Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan and former state senator William Ligon invoked that language earlier this summer as they sought to avoid appearing before the special grand jury. But in early July, Superior Court Judge Robert C.I. McBurney of Fulton County, Georgia, took a position similar to Judge May's, ruling that the men must testify but should not be made to answer questions prohibited by the state immunity clause.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha.
I have frequently said that if the poems that you recite in the beginning contain moral lessons, they are very valuable, They should be ideological as well as moral. For example, some but not all of Saib's sonnets are truly valuable. Today, our poets who compose poems with a religious theme, especially about the lives of the Imams, are working on these matters as well. I should add that you elegists and poets who compose poems with a religious theme help one another. You elegists help to improve their poetry. By reciting their poems, you arouse the excitement of these poets and help them to improve their poems. So you help the poet and the poet helps you as well. When you recite good poems in the morning ceremonies, you are in fact giving value to your own position. Well, this important movement, taking people into the depths of history and purifying and polishing hearts, requires art and artistic methods. In our elegies, this kind of art shows itself in the voice, in the song, and in the geometry of the recitation. These three things are definitely needed. A good elegist should have a good voice, a good song. In Arabic, this is rhythm and tone. And he should also know the geometry for reciting.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, some people know the latter and some do not. This is important to determine what you want to do in the morning ceremonies from the beginning. These things constitute the form of an elegist: a good voice, a good song, and a good management of one's recitation. These constitute the form. But the form should not take precedence over the content. All these things are instruments to be used for the content. One should not act in such a way that the content is lost. The teachings, affection, kindness, and that which gives direction to the movement society from the heart of the Hay'at should not be undermined and lost. This was another point about elegies. Another point is that in elegies, like in all other tasks, innovation and creativity are necessary. As you have witnessed, young people do innovative things in this area. In elegies, innovativeness is good and all right, but you should be careful that this innovativeness does not lead to the breaking of norms. Elegies have a special identity. Therefore, this identity should not be changed.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
سید امین عالمی، کابل.
شاهان بات، Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip to mark the anniversary of an arson attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1969. 53 years ago, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds was set on fire by an Australian Zionist named Dennis Michael Rohan in coordination with Israeli officials and military forces. Hundreds of people attended the national conference, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
We warned the Zionist enemy against making any stupid moves towards the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. We're willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We call on all Arab leaders to boycott the Israeli regime because it poses a great threat to all nations.
Soon after the arson attack, the Israeli regime increased the Judaization and settlement building in Al-Quds. Palestinian officials accused Arab regimes normalizing ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The shameful normalization of ties between Arab countries and the Israeli regime is encouraging our enemy to carry out further attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Arab governments must stop encouraging the Israeli regime to violate the rights of the Palestinian people and their sacred sites. Al-Quds is the core of the Palestinian struggle.
This year's anniversary comes amid an escalation of Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims and Palestinians who consider it as the capital of their future state.
Al-Quds will always be in the heart of the Islamic nation, and all attempts by the Israeli regime to change its status are doomed to fail. On this sad occasion, we call on all Arabs and Muslims to support Al-Quds and to support Palestine.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the heart of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice. Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A timeless beauty that tells stories from Iran's rich artistic heritage. Persian carpets are on display in the 29th Iranian Handwoven Carpet Show in Tehran. The event has brought under one roof producers of hand-woven carpets and pictorial rugs from across the country to showcase their latest designs.
The Persian carpet represents the identity of Iranians. Today, you can see machine-made carpets which are significantly lower in quality compared to the hand-woven ones. So this expo helps reintroduce the importance of hand-woven rugs to the people.
For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented Iran's culture and art. Its unique design and quality have turned the ancient handicraft into a lucrative commodity on the global stage. Less than three decades ago, this sublime art used to be a major export earner for Iran, a viable source of income that accounted for almost one-fifth of the country's non-oil revenues. But today, this is no longer the case, as producers are warning that the Iranian carpet is losing its shine in the global market. From an annual revenue of up to $1 billion in the 1990s, the export of Iranian carpets has slumped to almost zero. One reason behind this freefall has to do with U.S. sanctions, says carpet trader who used to export to Europe before Washington's anti-Iran measures tightened the screw on the Persian carpet.
In the wake of the sanctions, it's safe to say that our carpet exports have dropped to almost zero. Complications in money transfer are one of the impacts of the sanctions, and the unwillingness of foreign clients to buy from us is the other result, because they fear U.S. punishment if they interact with us.
In 2018, another challenge came into play to knock the Persian carpet out of the global market once and for all. Surprisingly, it's a domestic issue. Since the depreciation of the Iranian rial, the government has imposed tight controls on currency liquidity, which require exporters to return their hard currency proceeds to the country within a very short period of time.
The government is not helping us, yet it's been creating problems for us by the so-called currency treaty. It's impossible to return the proceeds within only 2 months. We need time to sell our carpets in foreign countries where demand for our hand-woven carpets has declined.
The absence of genuine Iranian carpet